Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus on Albany. I'm Cynthia Pooler, and my guest today is Mayor Kathy Sheehan, Mayor of Albany. The first thing I'd like to say, Mayor, is belated Happy Mother's Day. And also, please accept my condolences for your son and his birth family. I hope everybody's, you know, doing okay.
It's a very difficult time. Thank you.
I'm sure it is. So you've been mayor for almost 3.5 years, and in those 3.5 years, there have been many, many issues that have been pretty controversial. So let's start with the issue on hand, which is Rezone Albany, and that's going to be voted upon this evening, correct?
That's right.
So can you explain to everybody a little bit of what Rezone is and why it's important?
Sure. You know, we undertook a real effort in this city a few years back, actually under the prior administration, to develop the city's first comprehensive plan. And that plan, the 2030 plan, was the document that grew out of many public meetings, people literally going, you know, door to door, collecting information. And it really is a vision for the city and for the future of our city. And so in order to move that plan forward, we then had to undertake the difficult work of looking at our own rules and regulations and determining what was working and what wasn't working with respect to our ability to execute on that comprehensive plan. And so Rezone is, again, the result of a lot of public input, a lot of public meetings, a number of charrettes that took place in different parts of the city to create a zoning code for the city that, A, reflects where we are now and what our neighborhoods are like and what we want for our neighborhoods, and that also is easier to navigate. So instead of a lengthy list of rules and text telling people what they can't do, we sought in this document to provide visuals and a clear understanding of what we want to see built in our various neighborhoods in the city of Albany. So it is a lot of hard work that goes into creating a new zoning code. It was a tremendous amount of effort on the part of not only our planning department, but a number of our common council members really got involved because they see on a day-to-day basis within their wards the challenges that their constituents have with respect to navigating zoning. And so it was really an effort that it took as much time as it took so that we could really ensure that we get it right. We are expecting it to pass tonight, and there's a built-in six-month review because we know that we're going to have to go back and ensure that what we intended is what is actually happening, and if there are things that were missed, that we have the opportunity at that six-month point to go in and ensure that we've got the code exactly the way that we want it.
There's a number of people in the city and a few of the mayoral candidates who would like the issue tabled into the next administration, whether it be you or somebody else. What's your thought on tabling until the next after the election?
Well, I see absolutely no reason for that. This is not a political document. This is a document that grew out of public meetings, public input. We have literally tens of millions of dollars of investment waiting for this rezone. We can't expect ourselves to be a successful city that attracts new residents and attracts new businesses if we continue to labor under a zoning code that is difficult to navigate, that isn't clear with respect to the rules, and that continues to provide these one-off opportunities for spot zoning and for special treatment that you have to get 7 variances if you want to open a restaurant on Lark Street. You know, we have to, you know, join the rest of the country and the rest of successful progressive cities in ensuring that we have a zoning code that our residents and our businesses can easily navigate and understand. You know, we found certain areas in the city where 80% of the parcels in that zone were non-compliant. Now, there's something wrong with your rules when 80% of the buildings don't follow those rules. And so we had to adjust and look at neighborhoods that are multifamily. We had to look at the fact that we really want to incentivize mixed-use development, and we were not providing for that opportunity. A number of areas where we have high vacancies and those red X's, those are the result of the fact that our zoning code didn't allow to be rebuilt what was already there, which were multifamily units. And so I think it's really important that we move forward and get this document implemented. It is aligned with the 2030 plan, which, as I said, was passed under the prior administration. This has been the result of a lot of input and a lot of collaboration and cooperation. And again, it has a 6-month revisit where we will have the opportunity and the council will have the opportunity to raise issues. So it's time to move forward. And I think to politicize this document really does a disservice to our residents and our businesses.
One issue that was brought up in the wintertime, that was voted upon in the wintertime, was the trash tax. I had gone to that common council meeting where an overwhelming majority of the people were against it, and they said it was discriminatory, but it passed anyway. What's your thoughts on the trash tax?
So let's go back to, 2014. We inherited a budget that had a significant deficit built into it, and that deficit actually ended up being worse than what was built into the budget. And we had to navigate to a 2015 budget that would allow us to actually have a balanced budget. I am constitutionally required to balance the budget. And so as we looked at building a 2015 budget, we had a significant gap to fill, and we sought additional aid from the state. We know that we don't get our fair share, but we also know that with the landfill closing, we have to prepare our residents for the future of solid waste management in the city of Albany. And so the legislation that was passed at that time, so it was passed so that it could be implemented with respect to the 2016 budget. So in 2015, we proposed in the budget that we would start to charge a fee. Everybody would get one pickup for free, so that wouldn't change. One unit gets a no charge for the trash, and then for each additional unit, there would be a fee. We realize that it's imperfect, and we ask the council to pass that legislation to have a 3-year window for us to then continue the work that we're doing to plan for solid waste management when the landfill closes. And we've been doing that. We want to move to a system where we incentivize people to recycle. We know that recycling rates in the city are not where they should be. The people who are complying are doing a great job, but we still have a number of residents that just simply aren't recycling. And so we need to ensure that we have a system that incentivizes that and that incentivizes reducing waste. The current system doesn't do that, and I understand the frustration over it, but it is a bridge, and we are actually going to be having a number of meetings over the next month and a half where residents can come out, they can learn about our solid waste management system, what it costs, the efforts that we've undertaken to seek to reduce costs and to automate some of those services, and then to give them an overview of what other cities are doing across the country and in New York State with respect to the management of their solid waste. We want to get input from our residents about what it is they would like to see and give them an understanding of the options that are available. There are communities that have a bag system where you have to purchase a certain bag to dispose of garbage, pay as you throw. There are other communities that have a bin system, and so the size of your trash bin determines the cost associated with solid waste removal. And also ensuring that people understand that recycling is mandatory in this city, and that the more we recycle, the less expensive it's going to be for us to dispose of that solid waste that ultimately has to go to a landfill.
Now, there were a number of common council members who voted for the trash tax, which kind of like angered the people that were there and also people who weren't at the meeting. Do you think the trash tax is going to have an impact on the elections for the common council this year?
You know, I certainly can understand nobody wants to pay more for something. And so, but you look at the city's budget and the challenges that we face, and the trash fee is, again, it's assigned to income-producing properties. So it's that second unit, third unit, or fourth unit. And it is focused on looking at the fact that as we move towards closing the landfill, the cost of solid waste management is only going to grow. And so you can pay that for that through increasing our property taxes, or you can pay for it by charging for that service that is being provided. And so we're going to determine over these next, you know, couple of months and get input from our residents. I certainly don't expect anybody to come forward and say, I want to pay more money. I certainly don't want to pay more money either. But the reality is that it is going to cost more money for us to dispose of our garbage, and we have to find a way to pay for it. Now, you know, in looking at the city services that we provide, I believe that we do an excellent job of providing city services, but we continue to look across all departments at opportunities for savings. And what we're trying to do, and what my administration is trying to responsibly do, is to ensure that we can continue to provide a safe and healthy city, services that are critically important to our residents, while at the same time determining how we can better pay for those important services. And so that is the conversation that we will have, you know, with the community over the next month and a half, and that we will continue to have, because we're going to take the information that we get from these solid waste management meetings, and we're going to take that information. We're working with a consultant. We're working with a group of common council members. And then we will be going back to the community with a couple of options. We hope to have a minimum of two different options so that we can determine what our residents want us to do moving forward. But I can't change the fact, and nobody sitting in this office can change the fact, that it is going to get more expensive for us to dispose of our solid waste when the landfill closes. That's simply a reality. And I'm not going to sugarcoat that or to mislead our residents, because they deserve to have the facts as we make these decisions and determinations going forward.
You have a number of outstanding labor contracts. I remember at your last State of the City address, there was groups of workers who were protesting that they're still working without a contract. How many unions are without a contract in the city of Albany?
Well, we actually are in the process. We are in the process of settling a number of contracts. We're going to be announcing the settlement of a number of our contracts. Unfortunately, the group that protested at City Hall, I could not have agreed more. We wanted to settle our contract. That was our blue-collar union. And when the budget passed, literally the day after the budget passed, the first union that we contacted was the blue-collar union. We wanted to sit down with them. We wanted to ensure that we could get a contract. They deserve a raise. And as you know, I cannot speak about negotiations. I am prohibited. It would be an unfair labor practice for me to disclose anything that was offered to them. But what I can say publicly is that I believe strongly that our blue-collar workers deserve a raise, and I want nothing more than to give them a raise. And unfortunately, we were not able to reach an agreement with their leadership, and so that contract remains outstanding, but we have made significant progress, including my administration reached a settlement with the firefighters union. And when I asked when was the last time the city was able to settle with its firefighters as opposed to having our contract have to go to mandated arbitration, that nobody could recall the last time we were able to reach labor peace with our firefighters union. So we remain committed to working with our collective bargaining units and making progress in getting them the raises that they deserve. Again, I have to balance a budget. And so in looking at, you know, it's very challenging. It's a challenging environment. And it is understandable that our employees want to ensure that we have the ability to give them raises, but we also want to ensure that we don't have to engage in unnecessary layoffs and unnecessary cuts in city services. So that's what we have to balance, but we've made significant progress, I'm pleased to say, with our most of our unions.
I know that there's a conference of mayors. There's one in New York State, and I think there's one nationwide. When you meet other mayors, and you start talking about what's good and what's bad about their cities and your city, do you find a lot of similarities? Are a lot of mayors approaching things differently than how you're approaching things? And have you learned a lot from other mayors?
Well, you know, one of the things that I've enjoyed about participating in both the U.S. Conference of Mayors and the New York State Conference of Mayors is to really see our city through the eyes of other mayors. My first year in office, I attended a design conference for mayors where they take mayors from, you know, 7 or 8 different cities, and they bring resources to us. And again, this is all at no charge to the city, planners, designers, transportation experts. And each mayor brings a particular issue to that conference that they want to do a deeper dive on and get other perspectives about. And I was there. There were a number of mayors from across the country at that design conference. And to a person, they were amazed at the incredible infrastructure that we have in the city, the beauty of our city, the quality of our neighborhoods. And so, you know, we sometimes can get focused on, you know, what the challenges are. And I don't want to minimize our challenges, but it's sometimes refreshing to see other mayors who, you know, some of them even in cities that are more affluent than the city of Albany, look at our city and what we do and how we do things and the infrastructure and possibilities and potential that we have and really see how much they admire it. The U.S. Conference of Mayors recognized our Summer Youth Employment Program as one of the best in the country. We have a Summer Youth Employment Program that not only provides quality work opportunities, which was something when I came into office, there were a lot of complaints about, didn't feel that the kids were being given quality work opportunities, but also quality opportunities for enrichment so that our young people see a pathway to college, see a pathway to a career, learn about financial management, and what they can be doing even as teenagers to prepare for their future and strengthen their relationship with the police department. And our police department, you know, nationally recognized. I go to these conferences and I have police chiefs and mayors who want to talk to me about the progress that we've made in our police department such that we are one of 15 in the country. We didn't apply for this. The U.S. Department of Justice looked across the country and looked at departments that were embracing 21st century policing strategies that they could hold out as models to other departments, and they came to us and asked us if we would be willing to be one of those 15 departments. So, you know, there are also opportunities to learn about how to do things in a different way. We are looking at buying back our streetlights, for example, and there are other cities that have done that, so we don't have to reinvent the wheel. You know, we want to be able to build on the success of what's happened in other cities in order to take advantage of that.
I'm glad you mentioned the word infrastructure. There was a bill introduced this last year to talk about municipal internet in the city of Albany, and that hasn't been addressed yet. And technology is going to be, it is the wave of the future. And I would think municipal internet would do a lot to help small businesses and to help people who might not be able to afford internet in their homes to do so. How do you feel about municipal internet?
Well, you know, this is an area where, you know, in some sense, waiting has helped us because the technology is moving really rapidly. And so we did do a study. We have a broadband advisory group. They hired a consultant. And, you know, the idea of municipal internet and fiber to the homes was looked at and was prohibitively expensive, tens of millions of dollars to bring fiber to the home. And we had hoped that some of the $500 million of internet money that the state had available would be available to municipalities for those types of projects. And as it turns out, the rules that the state put in around that funding really was targeted at rural areas. And so cities like Albany and Rochester were not able to access that pool of funding. And so the broadband study is actually being reviewed by the broadband committee. I've seen a final draft of it. And we are now, so there is an option that's laid out in there for, I think that's what you're talking about, fiber to the home, you know, municipal internet. Mm-hmm. But there's also a recommendation with respect to, as we look to buy back our light poles, using those as an asset for the next generation, which is 5G technology. And you may have read about what happened in Troy where some companies got out ahead of the city and installed poles that then had to be taken down. But those poles are used for 5G, which is a wireless technology that would allow us the ability to have internet access throughout the city. So stay tuned. That report is going to be issued, and ultimately I'll look to the broadband committee for their recommendation, but it seems that that's the direction that we're going to be going in.
Another big, big controversial issue is the Palace Theater. Many people felt like we gave it away. The city gave it away. What's your position on the Palace Theater?
Well, again, you know, I mean, my background is in business. You know, I worked for a medical device manufacturer for a number of years, and I've been concerned about the Palace since I was city treasurer. The city has a 10-year lease with the Palace Theater. I believe there are 6 years left on that lease for a dollar. Okay, so if people were worried that we gave away the Palace, you know, that happened under the prior administration. That building, for as long as the Palace has operated it, has operated for a dollar. And the city, not only do they operate the theater for a dollar, but under that lease agreement, our taxpayers are responsible for all repairs to that building. A new HVAC system, if it needs a new roof, if it needs new electrical work, if the bathrooms need to be fixed, all of those are on taxpayer dollars. And so we sent in our engineering team because I wanted to know what that liability was, because it's a liability. It's not an asset. It's a liability. And that number is approaching $5 million in repairs that need to be done to that building. And you know, the Palace, as I said, pays us a dollar. So in looking at what the Palace is seeking to do, we could do those $5 million in repairs, and the building still isn't really adequate for what the Palace wants to do. And so they have come up with a vision for that building, and that vision includes the potential for a $60 million investment in that facility that would create a second theater, that would expand the stage, and that would expand the number of nights of programming that would occur there, which is great for downtown and for our businesses. So in order for them to really be able to fund that, they need to own the building. They need to be able to take advantage of what are called historic tax credits, which the Proctor's Theater in Schenectady, for example, that project probably would never have gotten done if they had not been able to take advantage of historic tax credits. And so we have worked out, and the council was involved, a negotiation. The appraisals for the Palace Theater came in at between $500,000 and I believe at the top end maybe $1.6 million is what that building is worth. And again, as I mentioned, we have a $5 million liability. And so we have worked out an agreement with the Palace. They will continue to provide the services that they provide. They provide that building for free for a number of events, community-related events. They are host to the Albany Symphony Orchestra. So all of those things will stay in place, and they'll be able to move forward to raise funding for what is a really exciting multi-million dollar project that will be done here in the city and will create jobs. So I think it's a win-win all the way around. We continue to get revenue for 20 years, 30, I think it's either 20 or 30 years, don't quote me, Cynthia, I can't remember now, I don't have the document in front of me, of revenue for the city, and they will take on the responsibility for those $5 million plus of repairs that otherwise would be at the feet of our taxpayers. By the way, we also insure that building. That costs our taxpayers almost $100,000 a year, so that obligation goes away. So, you know, I would say far from giving this building away, I think we've put it on a path to be able to grow in a way that it wouldn't be able to if the city owned it, and we have avoided some significant expenses for our taxpayers.
A major part of the controversy is the fact that you wear two hats and it's considered a conflict of interest.
Yeah, Cynthia, let me just stop you right there. So I sit as an ex officio member on many boards. Ex officio simply means that because I am the mayor, and it's whoever sits in the mayor's office, I have a seat on a board. I sit ex officio on the Albany Institute of History and Art. I sit ex officio on the Albany Symphony Orchestra, and I now sit ex officio on the Palace Theater. And I think it's important that the residents of the city of Albany have a representative on these boards because they are so important to our city moving forward. But my role is a non-voting role, so I am not a voting member of any of those boards. I attend the meetings when I can. I send a representative if I'm not available. But I think it's very important. I was shocked that the city did not have an ex officio role on the Palace board, and we owned the building. I mean, I can't think of a stronger argument for ex officio representation than the fact that we owned the building and we had no representation on that board. And so sitting on those boards gives me the opportunity to tell the board members of those institutions and the directors of those institutions about important city initiatives that are happening, to connect these institutions. So if something's going on at the Palace and I think that the Albany Institute might be a good partner, I can help to make those connections. But it's certainly not in any way, shape, or form a conflict of interest because I don't have a voting right on any of those boards.
Another important issue that was pretty controversial is the red light cameras. In two budgets, you had allocated money that you anticipated getting from the red light cameras. That revenue never happened. So can you give us an update on how the red light cameras are doing right now?
Well, first of all, it's important to note that I don't think there was ever a controversy about the need for a concerted effort to stop red light running in the city of Albany. It's rampant and it's not safe. This was always an initiative about making our city safer, and it was the result of a committee that the police department put together with representatives from the community to focus on public safety. The revenue did not materialize, and that happens. It happens in every municipality, in every budget, and we managed to our budget. We were still able to balance our budgets without that revenue, and we had always anticipated that that revenue would fall off significantly as we sought and received compliance with the rules of the road. And the other important factor for our taxpayers and our residents to understand is that this program did not cost us a penny. 100% of the cost of installing these red light cameras and operating them and sending out the tickets, all of that is borne by the company that we hired to operate this system. So we have safer streets and safer intersections at no cost, additional cost to our taxpayers. Is the revenue what we had anticipated? No. And I'll tell you part of the reason why the revenue isn't what we anticipated. First of all, we got compliance faster than most other cities have seen compliance. Second, because of advocacy on the part of common council members that these red light cameras not be used as a trap, right, for unsuspecting motorists, we implemented four-second yellows. So the light is yellow for 4 seconds, and as long as it's yellow when somebody enters the intersection, they don't get a ticket. We put in enhanced signage. And so those two things alone, while if you look at revenue that is far greater, some people could point to me and say, hey, in other cities, they receive $2 million, $2.5 million in revenue from these red light cameras. In part, it's because they don't have the safeguards in place that we have here. My goal was always safety and compliance, and I'm pleased to say that we are seeing that in the city. And again, these cameras were installed, and the cost associated were borne by the contractor who holds that contract.
Now, the last issue I'm going to talk about or ask you is the 12.5. But before I do that, you had put in your budget anticipated revenue from the red light cameras that never materialized, and that only increased the deficit. What do you say about that?
No, it really didn't, Cynthia. It did not increase the deficit. We were able to manage to that. We were able to manage to reduce our expenses when that anticipated revenue was not coming in. We also had areas where revenue came in higher than we anticipated. So, I mean, a budget is a plan. And, as any mayor will tell you, the real work comes in then managing to that plan. And there are things that happen, you know, when the recession hit and sales tax revenue, for example, fell off a cliff. The city had to manage to that. And so, you know, we're constantly looking at opportunities to, number one, increase revenue. So just because we have our revenue locked in on our budget, we're still going after other revenue streams all the time, whether it's through the Regional Economic Development Council grants, grant opportunities that come in through the Attorney General's office, through the U.S. Department of Justice. And so, there are years where we are very successful in that, and we're able to offset anticipated expenses with that grant revenue.
Now, let's talk about for a few minutes the structural deficit of 12.5. You got the 12.5 this year from the state. That's not going to last forever. We can't do that every year. So what's the solution to this structural problem in the city of Albany?
Well, Cynthia, I believe that my administration has demonstrated what the solution is. You know, it started when I got into office day one. opening our books to the state, to the Financial Restructuring Board, because I knew, number one, we needed to make some investments, and we didn't have the money to make those investments. I was left with a budget that spent the rest of our rainy day fund. So let's just be clear about where we started. This structural deficit, the city has been deficit spending since at least 2007. And actually, if you look at how we operated the landfill, how the prior administration operated the landfill, that deficit spending has been going on for much longer than that. So, you know, we started by opening our books to the state and saying, we know that we need to invest in technology. It's going to cost us a significant amount of money. We want the Financial Restructuring Board to front load that money, give us the cash to make those investments so that we can start getting that return on that investment immediately. And we were successful in convincing the state to do that. The following year, we were successful in saying, here we are, we're making the investments, we're doing exactly what we said we were going to do, here is our budget, here are the cuts that we've made, because of course we started with a much bigger deficit. Our structural deficit that we started with was close to $20 million. And so we demonstrated where we were able to identify and find savings. And we asked for $12.5 million, not a spin-up, permanent aid. We got $12.5 million in a spin-up, right? The state said, okay, we're not going to, you know, we're not going to write you off just yet. We're going to give you the $12.5 million in a spin-up. But you now have to work with our consultant to build a long-term budget for the city of Albany so that we can plan for the future and see where you can get with respect to reducing the structural deficit. And so we did that. We then spent 2016 working with the state, again, demonstrating my administration's fiscal responsibility, the approach that we take, the professionalism with which we endeavor to ensure that we are good stewards of taxpayer dollars. And as a result of that, we received $12.5 million of new aid this year. That is unprecedented. It's not a spin-up. It's not borrowing from the future. It is new money, unprecedented. It hasn't been done before. And so now, as you said, we've got to get to the point where we have certainty. And so the next step is to demonstrate that we are executing on that plan and then creating that permanent bridge, because we can't continue to do what we are doing and be treated the way that we are treated compared to other cities in New York State. And that is how you go about creating a permanent bridge and permanent additional aid for the city of Albany. I will not sit here and say that we should get to the point where we don't need $12.5 million from the state. We deserve $12.5 million from the state. If you look at how the city of Albany is treated per capita compared to other cities, we have done more with less than any other city. And on top of it, we have the highest percentage of tax-exempt property of those cities. And so we need to fight for, and I will continue to fight for, the residents of the city of Albany, because they shouldn't be asked to pay a higher tax bill simply because we aren't willing to fight for them and for our fair share of aid from the state. And so I have worked hard to build a strong relationship with the governor's office, with the state budget office, and with our legislators. You know, Cynthia, I spend a lot of time talking to legislators from across the state, telling them the story of Albany, giving them an understanding of the challenges that we face. And many of them had no idea. I've had legislators say to me, how can the city of Albany have a challenge? Look at Cross Gates Mall. That's got to bring in a lot of money for you. Well, why would a legislator on Long Island know that Cross Gates isn't in the city of Albany? It's in Guilderland. So we have to, you know, really build that relationship and talk about what our challenges are. They look at the jobs that we have here in state government, but I have to educate and make sure that they have an understanding that while we have thousands of jobs here, it's because our population doubles in size every day. These people are coming here to work from outside the city. And then they ask about sales tax revenue, and then I educate them, right? Sales tax is shared countywide. So it doesn't benefit us necessarily just because they're spending money in Empire State Plaza, you know, which is tax exempt, buying their lunch. And so it's about education and relationship building. And I believe that it's incredible that in 3 years, we've been able to get unprecedented new money for the city of Albany. And I will continue to fight for that fight. And I believe that my administration has been recognized for its fiscal responsibility by this additional aid that is new money provided by the state.
Two more questions. One of the something that's talked about a lot is the fact that when new businesses come in, they're given tax exempt status, which is off the tax rolls, which makes it more difficult for homeowners to, you know, keep up with everything. How much of Albany is tax exempt, and what will you do to change that?
Okay, so let me just there are two different things issues that you're talking about. So about 63% of the property in the city of Albany is tax exempt. Okay, 61 to 63%, and most of that is the state, right? So 60% of that tax exempt pool is state-owned property. And we need to remember that being home to a state university and being home to state government does generate some revenue for the city of Albany. You know, those institutions, they pay for water and sewer services. They're not exempt from that. And they do generate sales tax revenue. And those buildings do help to keep property values in the city higher than in other areas. But the issue that you're talking about with respect to new for-profit businesses, we do provide, this is done through an independent board, the IDA, which is 100% of the IDA members are appointed by the Common Council. So as mayor, I do not have any representation on the IDA board. That is 100% the Common Council. But what the IDA has done, and I used to be a member of the IDA board and pushed very hard for this, was that we've created, and that board has created, a clearer set of rules so that businesses that are looking to invest in Albany understand what the rules of the road are. And those rules start with no project will pay less in property taxes than they paid before they started. So if somebody takes a building that's worth $1 million, they will always pay property taxes on that $1 million. That payment will come to the city. If they invest $10 million in it, right, they have the opportunity, and it depends on which program they go under. Some are state tax exemptions that are as of right because it's built into state laws, and others are granted by the IDA. They get an exemption for a portion of that growth from $1 million to $10 million, right? And at the end of that pilot period, 100% of that building, which has now been increased in value, becomes fully taxable. So that's a different type of exemption. So they're not completely exempt from taxes, but the amount of their investment, the amount that they increase the value of that property, is taxed at a scaled level. So 10% the first year, then 20%, then 30%, typically all the way up to the 100%. And it can vary based on, as I said, the program that they seek an exemption under. So for our taxpayers, it's really important for them to know we keep the tax base whole, and we are doing this in projects that are resulting in increases to our tax base, right? So that we're growing the tax base, which benefits all of our taxpayers, because the bigger the base is, the lower the tax rate is. And my administration has held the line on property taxes, and that's very important. We already are taxed at, to me, unacceptably high rates, and so we have worked very hard to hold the line on taxes.
I've asked you a number of questions where I felt I put you on the hot seat. one last question that's kind of, you know, it's more friendly. Let me put it that way. What's the most fun part about being mayor of Albany?
You know, I love interacting with our young people. I really enjoy going to our schools. Anytime I have the opportunity to visit our amazing schools throughout the city, to be involved in activities that our young people are involved in, whether it's, you know, planting trees on Arbor Day or, you know, the Brighter Choice Charter School for Girls, you know, did a show. They actually did it at Green Tech, and it was just so great to see these young girls perform and, you know, just really so exciting to see them. I was able to speak at the high school graduation for the Girls Leadership Academy, which is also a charter school, and I'm also was invited to speak at the Hackett Middle School graduation. So really interacting with our young people is really important because there are so many job opportunities that are available, and that's something that, you know, it still is a surprise in our community. The biggest challenge that I hear from businesses in the city of Albany is that they are having trouble finding qualified workers. And I want to make sure that our young people know that there is opportunity out there for them, that if they focus on school, if they focus on making the right choices and being involved and taking advantage of after-school programs and sports opportunities, that there really are great career paths out there for them, and that we've got a business, you know, businesses here who want nothing more than for them to succeed academically and be ready for the workforce.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. You've been listening to Mayor Kathy Sheehan of Albany, and I hope you'll come on Focus on Albany as the campaign unfolds. So you have been listening to... Go ahead, Kathy.
No, I just want to say thank you very much, Cynthia. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. You've been listening to Mayor Kathy Sheehan, and if you like this show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download on your smartphone, subscribe to iTunes. If you have a comment about this show, hashtag Focus on Albany. And be sure to tune in to 107.3 on your dial, the brand new station in Albany, WCAA, low power FM. And I will be hosting a morning show on Mondays from 6 to 10. Thank you, Mayor Sheehan, and thank you everybody for listening. Have a wonderful day.